Welcome to Software Gone Wild. Today we are in sunny Zurich, in the best country, well, second best country of Europe, Switzerland. And I'm sitting in the wonderful offices of Switch, which does not stand for a top of rack device, but for, what does it stand for?
We claim it's not an acronym anymore. I think it was something Swiss Telecommunications for Higher Education at one point, but forget about that. Yeah. It's just Switch.
Even our old guys now say that it's not an acronym at all.
So it stopped being an acronym.
Yes. Good. So but we are the Swiss NREN, as it's known in the European community, the National Research and Education Network, as the ISP of all the Swiss educational institutions.
And you have a great thing, because actually what you do is switching packets.
Yes. Yeah.
To introduce my guests, Simon Leinen is an old friend of the show. You've been on two podcasts so far, mostly quiet on one of them.
Yeah.
And he organized this talk with Alex Gall. You also work for Switch?
Yes. So I'm part of the team that runs the actual network. Switch has grown over the years. It's now like 100 people. But the core team that runs the network has remained pretty much stable. So we are about 10 people responsible for the entire network, including the optical layer up to the IP routing.
Just before we go into the real stuff, so you mentioned you run the network. I know that you are in the cloudy business.
Yes, I used to have run the network, but then I got moved.
You got promoted into the cloudy heights.
Into the cloudy areas, right.
So what else is Switch doing?
Oh, yeah, we provide a bunch of other services to the community. Maybe I should also mention the domain name business for .ch and also the .li for Liechtenstein, where we sort of maintain the top-level zones. Although the actual registration is done by other entities now. But in the university area, we provide other services such as a federated identity system called the Switch AAI and a couple of services for lecture recording, remote collaboration, these kinds of things, which I miss a lot. Yeah, just a few examples. We also have a very strong security team who work not just for the university scene, but also start offering services to the commercial world and to.
And as we discussed before, she said that the network is like 10 people, the networking team.
We're a small team. Mm-hmm. Altogether, we're like 10 people, but half of them are like optical guys.
Mm-hmm.
So it leaves like 4 or 5 people who do the actual IP stuff, which is very small, and they can do stuff like that, and it works well. It works a lot better than any other like commercial or professional solution.
And the average of these 5 people have been at the company for 10 years or so.
Yeah, that's what I said, and it's a very, very low turnover. So that's the environment that we work in. I guess this is also that makes it possible for me to do the thing that I'm doing that we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
That I can very well imagine this has no place like in a commercial company where you kind of go develop stuff which also costs money in some form, time and so forth. But we are kind of in a lucky position that we can actually. So we have the know-how that we know what we want, what we're missing, what we want to change, what the vendors don't give us, and we have the luxury to be able to actually do this ourselves, which is very nice.
You were talking about how you collect all the IP addresses and everything with Postgres scripts. So your whole network management is like homegrown stuff.
Yeah, basically the monitoring is like probably more mainstream, RTS, these things and stuff like that. But the rest is pretty much scripts, like we generate DNS from the stuff we extract from the router configuration, and it's all automated.
So reverse DNS mapping for IP addresses on the interfaces, so you see the interface address.
Yeah, the real ones, the ones that are actually configured. This is the only way to get this right.
Of course.
It's fully automated. Some of the scripts are like 10 years old.
What about service provisioning? So when you connect a new customer, do you go and manually configure the interfaces?
Basically, yes, because our service is very simple. It basically IP connectivity,
mm-hmm.
and usually the BGP, which is very simple. So we either do it by hand right away, or the normal ways we write the snippet of iOS config,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a tool, another script that we use to move this piece of config to the router and install it. And
mm-hmm.
then it gets backed up into Ansys. That's how we do it. Because our services are so simple, this is like the most economic way.
Yeah, so you effectively provide internet connectivity to Swiss academics.
Right. Yeah. So the thing that we've added in the past years, and that also relates to what we're going to talk about,
mm-hmm.
is that we also have, well, layer two VPNs.
So mm-hmm.
for some reason, our customers want to have.
I'll not go into that.
Right, exactly. So that's
some people still believe Earth is flat, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. So why they want to do it, that's an issue by itself. We could spend hours talking about that. But, okay, so they give us money for that, and we cannot refuse that. We also not want to make them happy, and we cannot tell them, look, this is stupid, what you want to do. So you want to help them to get what they want. And then the problem is that we are forced to do this in a certain way with our vendor, which is to do it on top of MPLS, and this is what we don't like. So that's where the whole thing develops from.
Yeah, most vendors would tell you, well, use EOMPLS
LTTP3. And that's basically the only thing they give you. It depends a lot on the platform. Like with our Cisco gear, that's the only thing we have.
Yeah.
Except for the new ASRs that we just bought.
They
thanks
do,
to Deutsche Telekom, they
LTTP3.
A very crippled version of it. I've been on top on IPv6, but it's nice. So it only works for point-to-point tunnels, not
mm-hmm.
for multi-point tunnels. That's a step in the right direction. So.
Yeah.
But apart from that, we are actually stuck with Ethernet over MPLS,
mm-hmm.
and that's something we don't really like because it's the only reason for us to run MPLS. We don't do any other things that people use MPLS for these days. We don't do any traffic engineering. We don't need this crazy sub whatever 50 millisecond rerouting time that people
mm-hmm.
talk about. We don't have these strict SLAs. The only reason why we run MPLS is to provide these VPNs. And so we also restricted it very much to exactly this service. So we don't use MPLS for any other routing of anything else.
Mm-hmm.
This is all still plain IP. But still, so it restricts, we have to enable MPLS in the entire network, otherwise
yes.
we don't have full redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
Our backbone design is also a bit special, like, we only have the core.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have like an access layer or something. On all our customers are connected to a core pod, basically. Those are all core routers. But we also have very small sites where we have some sort of tiny kind of access layer. But so if those customers want to have this feature, they need a device that knows MPLS. And
yes.
those are not the cheapest devices, typically because it's an ISP feature and all
mm-hmm.
that. But this also restricts us. We have to put a box that's probably more complicated, more complex, more expensive in that place. And we need to. So that's another reason why we don't like this MPLS solution, apart from like the religious reason that it's connection. Oriented networking is just a bad thing, and it doesn't solve any problem that I can see, at least.
Well, MPLS makes sense if you use it throughout your network for
yeah.
majority of your needs. If you have to turn a new technology on in your network just to support two endpoints,
yeah.
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, right. Also, I can see that point, but it also then restricts your customers. I mean, of course, from the ISP perspective, that's also a good thing, because inter-domain MPLS does not exist, or only in very restricted environments. You know, you have to agree on a lot of things. And I can see that actually in Xeon. This is a
mm-hmm.
good example. They have now this multi-domain VPN service. They had to create a service for this, so you can connect these things together and extending your LSPs across these domain boundaries and so forth. But it's complicated and only works like in this close-knit environment where you have a project that coordinates things and blah blah blah, but you cannot in a commercial environment. You know, you cannot extend your VPN from your ISP to another location where you're connected to ISP B. There's no way you will get your
And yeah, LNS tunnel across this is not going to work. This is a fundamental restriction which doesn't need to be there. Mm-hmm. It's just a tunnel, right?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why we fight for this. We just had a very nice example of a customer of ours, an institute from a customer of ours. They want to participate in a project, like pan-European project, where people decided, the project leader decided they need a layer 3 VPN because they use private addresses and so forth. So now they're forced to, because we don't provide layer 3 VPNs, we cannot participate directly in this scheme. We cannot extend their MPLS-based VPN across our network to the school, mm-hmm. let alone in the school there, to that particular lab. So
they wanted to connect labs of individual size.
Basically, yes.
In a separate MPLS-based layer 3 VPN across multiple service providers.
Then it's a nightmare. So now we have like a snippet of a new MPLS tunnel for a point-to-point link, and then they have like a proxy in the Xeon network where like all the VRF stuff is done. But we just run like a snippet of a pseudo wire, and then we have like a point-to-point Ethernet, IP subnet on top of that, and we have to run BGP on top of that, and it's a nightmare, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't need any of this. None of this is necessary. If you just run it over IP, you know, that service would not exist. They could just, all the endpoints could just do that directly. That's kind of my vision how things would be, which is weird because that's like the ancient IP model. There's nothing new, certainly not.
Yeah.
It's just the most straightforward, most simple way I can imagine to do this. And nobody does. Nobody can. That's amazing, I think. People get used to running this complicated stuff. And they're probably also kind of, they like to run these services. So they really think, oh, this is an added value. And it does not occur to them that that could be an even simpler solution to the problem. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things, not that I would defend anyone running MPLS, even though I wrote a book on the subject. One thing is like you're locked into certain mentality. When certain thing has been done a certain way for the last 20 years, then maybe this is the way we should do it.
Hmm.
The more technical part of it is that the moment you start doing IP over IP tunneling, you know, you get into the problem of NTUs and broken path NTU discovery and jumbo frames.
With any encapsulation, even if it's just like a short MPLS label and people want to run 1500 bytes orbit, you're already in that domain. But yes, you're right.
Yeah. So talking about before we go into the NTU issues, how did you solve this problem of establishing an IP tunnel end-to-end between two sites for a reasonable price, let's say.
Like the way we run our current service?
No, what you plan to do.
Oh, what you plan to do, yeah. With this application then, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is actually, it's a simple replacement where I provide a tunnel in a simple IP encapsulation. So the idea is that I will buy like cheap hardware, right? A rack-mountable standard PC with a couple of interfaces. The way the service looks now, our interface is a port on our access device. So whenever one of our customers orders these layer 2 VPNs, he gets an additional port, either a 1 gig or a 10 gig port, or a pair of them.
Mm-hmm.
So the interface will look the same, just that this port is now on my own device that I built. And the device is basically very simple. It just takes all the Ethernet frames coming in this port, adds an encapsulation of my choosing. Right now, I chose to do that on top of IPv6 only. There's no reason for us to run it on top of that. It would be simple to do. And then I can have either a GLE header or this LTTP V3 keyed IPv6 tunnel, as they call it, which is also basically the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
calling it LTTP V3 is like overkill. It's so castrated, it only has like two fields, a session and a key, and that's it. And it uses the protocol field identifier of LTTP V3. That's it.
So it's GRE rebranded.
Sort of. I was wondering why they did that, actually. So it'd be interesting to hear somewhere from Deutsche Telekom why they did it that way.
because it looks new to me. Maybe it's because the GRE only have like this, the key can only be 32 bits,
mm-hmm.
and with their version they can have 64 bits. It's basically the only difference I can see.
Oh, I never look into LTTP 3 point-to-point links, but traditional LTTP gives you signal.
Right, and that's not present there. It's just, That's why I'm saying it has basically nothing to do with LTTP3 except that the header sort of looks like an LTTP3 header,
mm-hmm.
but there's no signaling, nothing whatsoever. So it is basically really, it is just GRE.
So you're configuring pseudo wires and you call them LTTP3 pseudo wires, but it's effectively
without
just IP encapsulation,
exactly.
Decapsulation.
Yeah, that's it. There's no signaling.
But since we're speculating, maybe the evil plan behind this is that if we get the vendor to support the encapsulation in hardware, then we can later make them add a signaling plane and realize our grand visions for LTTP3 that we had designed like 15 years ago.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. Possibly. That could be the
most
smart muscle. Yeah, it would be interesting to find out. But so anyway, to me, these are like two equivalent encapsulations, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I did both of them so because we also have these ASRs that
mm-hmm.
have this LTTP3 version implemented, and my stuff should be compatible with them. So I can have
So you could use ASR as a head end.
And as one of the endpoints,
yeah.
And one of my boxes as the other endpoint.
Yeah.
So that would work. It's very simple. So my device will simply take the frames that come in from this attachment circuit
mm-hmm.
from the customers and just add these headers, and then the upstream interface is connected directly to the router that's co-located, like the regular access device
mm-hmm.
of the customer. And from there on, it's a regular IPv6 packet. So I use dedicated loopback addresses for the endpoints, and I just do the reverse at the endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, as we've just been talking about MTU, so there is no fragmentation built into my application. So I have to make sure that...
Jumbo frames end-to-end.
Yes, so but we didn't have to change anything because we've been traditionally running like 9K MTUs in our background. That is exactly one of the reasons so that this is painless. Of course, inter-domain, that is a problem that we need to solve. That's true. So in our case, then both endpoints are in our network, so we can guarantee that it always works because we use jumbo frames in the background. So that's basically the whole thing. Even though I call this thing SDN, nobody really knows what it is, SDN, but to me it is something that enables me. It's a networking device that I can program more or less directly. I can make it do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence for me of this buzzword. Has nothing to do with OpenFlow, it has nothing to do with centralized control plane. Those things in like backbone network context, these things don't mean anything to me. I don't think there's a place for them there. There's a place for all that stuff at the very edge, in the data centers or clouds. If they want to do that and find a useful application, I don't care much. They're connected to me over an IP connection. As long as whatever they do, as long as what comes out there and goes in our IP packets, it would work with our network.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the idea, which is to turn this VPN service like in something that runs over IP and is indistinguishable from any other IP traffic. I would actually even prefer if the customers did it directly, so they wouldn't even have to buy like an additional port from us. And they wouldn't even have to talk to us if they want to do that. It would just be part of their regular IP traffic. And it will also work if they have an office in Beijing that could put a box there, which is work, obviously, as long as IP works.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, as a replacement for our existing service, it could be a drop-in replacement, which is plugging their cable into a different device, but otherwise everything stays the same, except for us, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We can eventually, if you have replaced all the VPN endpoints with this device, then you can... we'd actually be able to turn off NTRS in our network. So that's like the ultimate goal. If everything works out well, then that's what we could achieve with this.
You keep talking about this device.
Yes.
What's in this device?
Yeah, so it's the most simple thing you can think of. So it's just a standard PC hardware. I mean, just off the shelf, you can buy it anywhere. The only thing, it depends a little bit on the expectation on performance. So you should talk to Luke Gorey. So yep. I'm using this SnapSwitch framework for the programming, and everything he said about like performance issues is also true for me. Right now I have two for my prototypes, like one rack unit standard servers with Xeon CPUs and the Intel 10 gig report cards. So my goals with this SnapSwitch are different from what the other guys are doing with it, so the way I use it. And also my performance goals are probably a little bit different. I'm happy when I can run at 10 gigabit per second with not the tiny packets but realistic packets. So I run my tests with iProve with standard 1500 byte frames. And so my performance goal is that I can with one instance of the SnapSwitch software which runs in one core that I can handle 10 gigabit per second. And I think I can do that. Right now I'm limited by my rather oldish test systems at the very end, so I can only get like 6 gigabit per second, but this is not the end.
So the problem is you cannot generate enough traffic.
Yeah, right. Right now I cannot. But I'm very confident that I can do this. So for already now it handles up to 800,000 packets per second. So this looks very promising. And most of our customers use only 1 gig VPNs anyway. So I'm very confident that the performance issue is solved. So this is not a problem. So basically I took the framework that Luke provides with the SnapSwitch, and I just added what he calls apps that perform this encapsulation and decapsulation. So in the beginning it was very, very simple. It was just one app that did it, and then you start to realize, well, okay, so in the beginning you configure like the MAC addresses statically on both sides and you know, okay, just to see if it works. And now finally I actually have a very slimmed down, simplified version of IPv6 native discovery. So I don't need to configure the MAC addresses statically, and now I've also arranged so that I can have in one process I can terminate multiple EPLS instances if I want to, each of which can have several endpoints. So I basically implemented a single app that I call pseudo-wire that implements one tunnel endpoint. And then you can, in a VPLS with n participants, you just bunch together n, because you need a full mesh, you just take n of these pseudo-wires, and then you attach them to one physical port. And then you can have multiple physical ports that connect each to one VPLS instance, and it will all run in one process with one 10 gig uplink. So that's the service that I'm going to provide with this box.
So based on your service definition, you accept different VPN instances on different ports.
Yes.
But you could easily handle VLAN that, right?
Yes, yes. And right now it would just be transparent. So I don't look at the contents at all, actually, except for the MAC addresses for the MAC learning, because I have to implement the bridge for the VPLS. So that's the only thing that I look at. Otherwise, it's completely transparent. Whatever comes there, I will just pass it on. So people can run whatever they want across on top of it. As long as it's an Ethernet frame, I don't care.
So you also transparently pass across all the layer 2 signal protocols, like spanning tree, LACP, CDP.
Exactly. That's always an issue, like in the real world when you configure these things, then typically you have to configure like this layer 2 tunnels so that the local device does not consume the signaling packets that are actually meant for the other side and so forth. And there's no need to look at it locally anyway for my case, so I can just pass everything on. It's completely transparent. It really is like an Ethernet cable. Exactly like an Ethernet cable. It's the most.
Well, just the ability to pass on LACP packets is interesting. Because then someone can implement redundant design with this.
So my intention was to really have a true pseudo-wire in the true sense that you would get when you actually connected two devices physically. So it was a very clean definition of the service. And I'm sure that this will make the provisioning and the handling and the debugging a lot easier. We don't have so much experience actually with debugging this stuff because Although, unlike MPLS, it is very stable. Mm-hmm. It has to be, because so many people rely on it. The vendors have put a lot of effort and money into it to make it work. It works well. We rarely have problems with it. So we haven't been exposed to much of the troubleshooting, luckily, because that would be pretty hard, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the cases when you set it up and then there were exactly these kind of problems. People were running spanning tree across it and it didn't work and all of these problems. So I think that you have to simplify design where these problems just simply not exist and people get what they expect from a virtual wallet.
Yeah, that's the problem, because it's really hard for a vendor to define what people should expect, because every customer has a different expectation. Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so some people want to run spanning tree with the edge VPN edge device. Some people want to run it across. And
so it's understandable that, like, the vendors, if they want to satisfy everybody, stuff gets complicated. Of course, it could happen to us that people expect something that they cannot do. But then,
the source code is there. Do it.
Implement it. So when vendors talk to me about, like, so all the vendors write the SDN wave in some manner. And so they either expose like an OpenFlow interface or like Cisco does with the 1PK API, which I must admit I haven't never actually looked in detail at it, but it looks like more like a remote control of some form rather than letting me do something with the box that they did not think of yet. Because that's the true value for me. Right now, that I would like to ask a Cisco person who knows these boxes very well is, they already have hardware encapsulation in IP for different purposes. Like, you can encapsulate IPv6 and IPv4 over GRE in hardware. So this thing can do something. It can actually encapsulate certain frames in IP or IPv4 or IPv6. So that's already an important step. But it does not let me encapsulate Ethernet frames like the way I want it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not entirely sure if this is a limitation of the hardware or just the software. And that would be a very interesting case, because if the hardware allows me to do that, it's just the software that's missing. That would be precisely, to me, the reason for the existence of something like SDN. Because if then they expose like a low-level API to me, and well, first of all, I would ask them, do you have this feature? Do you want to give it to me? And they said, no, you're not important enough or whatever. But you have this API, you can do it yourself. Then I would be happy. That would be cool. So I have this device with this hardware capability. And right now, maybe it can do it, and it's not available to me because everything is closed. So that would be an extremely attractive feature to me. And it would actually make, in this instance, or in this case, it would make, I wouldn't have to create my own device to do that. Mm-hmm. If I have the ability to use an existing device that gives me the freedom to do something that the vendor hasn't thought of, but for some reason the hardware can do it, now I can use it because I can write this little piece of software myself. That would be really cool. That would be true SDN to me.
Well, it depends, as you said, on what they actually implement in the ASICs. If it's about hardware forward.
Exactly. So if the hardware can't do it, obviously there's no way to do it. Because you cannot do anything
itself. We don't have a clue how hard it is to envision everything people want to do with your hardware.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I just stumbled across a really interesting problem that one of the switch ASIC manufacturers has.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to bridge between a VLAN and a tunnel, it works well in both directions. So obviously bridging into the tunnel is simple.
Mm-hmm.
You do MAC lookup, you figure out that the next hop is an IP next hop, you have to add encapsulation, you send it. But the real problem is if something is coming from the tunnel, then you first have to do MAC lookup to figure out it's for you, then you have to do IP lookup to figure out that, yes, it's actually tunnel endpoint. Then you have to look into the inner header and grab the MAC address and do the lookup in the MAC address. They can still do that.
Okay.
But if you want to route a frame coming out of the tunnel, then they run out of the pipeline steps.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess no matter what the hardware people do, you will always find a case where it no longer works. that's another reason why I think all this powerful commodity hardware is extremely useful, because now you're in back in the old days where all the routers were just software, doing everything in software. Mm-hmm. And now we can do that again without, and still have good performance. And then you don't have all of these problems, because we can change it. You don't have to build a new ASIC.
You can do that at low 10 gig speeds.
Yeah, no, but it depends on exactly, of course, the more functionality, there always is a penalty. So your throughput goes down, the more stuff you need to do. There are many, many real-world applications, but this is good enough. So we're already in this ballpark where you can use this cheap and very flexible systems to do the things where we used to have to rely on these vendors building very expensive hardware-based boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the reason why I'm able to build my box and run it at 10 gigabit per second, maybe not with tiny packets, as I said, but with reasonable load. This is perfectly possible. And because it's just software, I can do the heck what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no limitations. It's just, you have to be careful, especially with this SnapSwitch software uses like the Lua language and so forth. Performance is not trivial. I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I spend most of my time figuring out how to make things faster and perform better and avoid garbage collection and stuff like that. So this is not trivial, but it's probably particular to this kind of system. If you use a different framework, then you may not have these problems. It doesn't matter. The point is that it's up to you. You just have to take your time, figure out how to do it. The system itself is not the limitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like your skills, or maybe you do use it in the wrong framework. It doesn't really matter.
Now that you mentioned the challenges you had implementing this, so let's start with the basic question. How long did it take for you to get to a place where you had a working prototype?
The first prototype that worked, that was very quick. Well, first of all, I had to learn the language,
mm-hmm.
Which was also not too difficult. It's basically Perl, Python, more or less
one of those.
Okay. And then just the basic terminal, I guess that was just a matter of days to get this running. But then I hit the first limitation because it was performing really badly. Of course, the very first version was just running in VMs,
mm-hmm.
So all in the local system, just to, so I got the bits right and the headers right. That was the first.
Well, this is interesting. So you can use a snap switch.
Ah. Right.
In a VM to test your ideas.
But that was also a thing that I did, because it was most of what I do is sort of orthogonal to what all the other people do with SnapSwitch,
mm-hmm.
just by the nature of it. Because I didn't have an Intel 10 gig card available, I didn't have one anyway. So the first thing I did, I wrote an interface where you could do raw I/O on a standard Linux socket.
Mm-hmm. So you effectively wrote code that can, where a standard Linux socket behaves like an Ethernet interface.
Well, actually, I take just a regular Linux Ethernet interface,
mm-hmm.
or any other network interface, and I use that instead of using the built-in driver of SnapSwitch. I just built an app that opens a raw socket and just passes packets back and forth. This is not, performance of course is terrible, but it was good enough to start working with it, and then you still get a couple hundred megabits per second anyway. So that
allowed you to create a development environment with no actual hardware.
Exactly.
So I could replicate that on my laptop if I wish.
Yes. And
work on the plane.
That's straightforward. So I had my test for VPN endpoints, virtual hosts, and the snap is running on the hypervisor, the snap switch. So I used that system just to get started, and I also wrote a little framework that allows me to easily handle protocol headers in a packet, because people are only concerned with passing on Ethernet frames, basically, with the actual purpose of the snap switch is a switch, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I need to look into packets, interpret packet headers, manipulate them, and so forth. So I spent some time writing my own little framework to help me simplify this and make the code more usable. So that's in the first phase when I did all that. And then I finally got my testing systems with the 10 gig cards. And then I realized the performance sucked.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working on that. That took me quite a lot of time, and it's still taking most of my time to find out where the bottlenecks are in my code, mostly related to the Lua runtime system. Mostly, actually, the garbage collection, which I consider to be one of the bigger issues with this platform. Because if you cannot really avoid this UI, then you will have periods in your process where the system is busy doing garbage collection. And if you're forwarding packet at a high rate and the system is doing something else for a millisecond, you lose a lot of packets.
Yeah.
So this is a bad thing. If this happens like in your packet processing. So I had to learn a lot of things. Well, actually, I'm not sure how much I actually learned, because a lot of it is just trial and error, because the Lua system that we use is Lua JIT, is a very sophisticated tracing compiler.
Mm-hmm.
I guess nobody except the person who already really understands. It's very dynamic. It's also incredibly fast. So when it actually finds a good trace to optimize it, it's fantastic, and it's very impressive. But because it is dynamic and it always figures out at runtime what to optimize. So if you load changes, or it has a probabilistic element to decide. Sometimes it just throws a dice, I guess, to figure out which trace to optimize, because they look more or less equal. So you can have, like, you compile the program and you run it in succession the same thing, and you will get fairly different. The profile will tell you it works very differently. Sometimes you get 20% garbage collection and the other time you get none. Like, this effect is typically then depends on an internal optimization of the system, where it can optimize certain object allocations away. But that only happens when this piece of code is compiled. Now, if the trace structure changes, suddenly this optimization no longer works, and then you get garbage. That was pretty difficult, and I'm not claiming that I actually understood what I was doing. I now have an idea what to avoid. There are also certain aspects of, like, it has a very powerful FFI to interface with C structures and functions. But also there, it's tricky, like, if you convert what they call a C data object into a Lua object, it always creates garbage because of create a container, so you have to create that container statically outside of your program or your function, and then reuse that, and all kind of tricky stuff. But my idea was, first of all, I thought, well, if this is the way I'm supposed to work all the time, maybe this is helpful. And the system is also meant for casual users to come and use it and extend it. And if they have to worry about these things, it's just not going to work. But if I'm able to put all of this into, like, a module that I can test, and I know this performs well, then I put it together, I don't lose any performance, because I have spent time to figure out how to do this right, then it is possible. And so far, I think my application is now grown. Like I said, in the beginning, I did configure static MAC addresses. Now I have a little layer that does the neighbor discovery stuff and passes on all the other packets. So it actually, all the traffic flows through that piece of code, and it only picks out, like, the little, every once in a while, when a neighbor discovery packet comes, it picks that out and does something with it, and everything else flows through it, and of course I don't want to lose performance there. And it turned out this works well. So I now have, like, 5 of these apps in a pipeline, and all the packets flow through all of them, and I still have the same forms as my initial very basic tunnel, where I get these 6 gigabit per second, which is limited by my testing system so far. So right now I'm convinced that I can make at least my application work well without running into these problems. That's good enough for me. I mean, I'm still spending lots of CPU cycles with stuff that's not really... I mean, you can, with a much more bare-bone design, you could be a lot faster, I'm sure, like trimming all the bits yourself, construct all the protocol areas yourself. This will lead to code that's not maintainable. Right now, I'm the only person who uses my framework, but even myself, if I write another app, I don't want to reinvent, like, even the Ethernet header. I don't want to copy-paste the code that, you know, writes the bits of the Ethernet header into my packet. I need, like, a centralized or a well-designed, debugged library that does that for me. Of course, this always costs you cycles, but I think, at least to me, this is worthwhile, and as long as I reach my performance goal, I think that's fine. But you will not be able to forward like 50 million 64-byte packets with the system. At least not in this hardware. But this is not my design goal. That's also a cool thing about the system, because you can decide yourself what you need to do. And the basic snap switch just is a very bare-bones system, and you can build on top of it whatever you want. If you want to forward packets at this rate, you have to do it differently than how I did it. And nobody stops you. You can just massage the system into a shape that suits your needs. And if anybody else ever wants to do something similar and you already did it, you can use that version of the system.
If I understand correctly, what you did was not just build your application, but also build a whole framework for parsing and processing and generating protocol headers.
Yes. That was the first thing I did, because it never occurred to me to do everything in this bare-bone way. I believe very much in reusable code. That's the only way to get actual maintainable and high-quality code. Everything else is, in my experience, well, I'm not a professional programmer. I don't do a lot of programming, but whenever I do that, whenever I can reuse a piece of code, I usually do it, even if it's only twice. So this was all missing, mainly because nobody else uses, you know, wants to manipulate packets at this level in the snap switch project, which is fine, of course. I'd be happy if somebody else comes along and wants to use something similar and could then make use of this library. That took me also some time to actually implement and find the proper API to make it useful.
So that now explains the things you were telling me before about the garbage collection.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are actually constructing things in a structured way, that is a lot of objects, which...
Exactly. That was maybe, I don't know if it was a little bit stupid or right away. To me, it was clear that like the protocol headers, they lend themselves very well to like an object-oriented design, because all of them, all protocol headers have something similar. They have like different fields, and then maybe there's a field that says what comes next and so forth. So it's very well suited to have a simple but natural object-oriented design with true inheritance where it actually makes sense. Many people use object-oriented design just because everybody does that, and then they construct terrible hierarchies that makes no sense, because you end up overriding everything because it just doesn't fit. But in that case, it seemed logical to do that. But then, of course, that's terrible. So imagine you have a loop that processes 800,000 packets per second. For every packet that comes in, it has to create an object just to parse the headers.
Oh, so that's what you did?
Yes.
Oh, that was slow.
But it turned out that it actually, it's pretty easy to get rid of most of the overhead. First of all, the allocation, because instead of just freeing the object, I just recycled it. I put it on the free list in the class of the object. And then the next time I call the constructor, it checks, do I have one on my free list? And then it just returns that. So instead of allocating millions of objects, the code now allocates maybe 20 objects. So that was the biggest step to reduce it. Of course, you still have the logic, because Lua uses hash tables for everything, even for arrays, which I think is, I don't like that construct a lot. But anyway,
it's an implementation decision.
Yeah,
let's leave it at that.
But then I do these lists, and so you still have to traverse lists and stuff. So it is. It, as I said, costs you cycles, but I found that I can do that in such a manner that I can maintain this object-oriented design and still have the performance that I want. I will never be as fast as if I, you know, as I said, if I just did everything like statically and put together my structures and manipulate the bits. You can never beat that. But that's basically programming in C or in assembly. Lose the benefit of the high-level language. And I was hoping that I would be able to actually use the high-level features of the language, even in a tight packet processing loop, which I find cool. And so far I think it works.
So looking back with all you've learned, you wouldn't go and re-implement the whole thing in C, for example?
As right now, no. I think that for this purpose, this is good enough. But I'm pretty sure that you will hit some limits. Also, maybe not just particularly because of the language and the programming environment, but the entire design would probably, because there's no protocol stack, right? This thing is so raw and bare bone that it just takes a packet from one interface, does a little bit something with it, and passes it on as fast as possible. What I did was it's a partial sort of implementation of a little something like a part of an IP stack. But of course, it's not layered like in a traditional operating system. I just split off the neighbor discovery, and I'm still adding the Ethernet header in a different part of the program, so I don't even have like a MAC layer or something. So if you want to build something that looks more like an IP router, you'd have to change the design to do that. There's also no control plane, there's no way to communicate with this thing. The only interface to the outside world is through these interfaces. So even the monitoring is not a problem, because I would like to implement MIPS like we use on our current system. We use the pseudo-virus MIPS to monitor our current VPNs.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be simple, like, so the snap is just running a regular Linux box. You can have an SMT daemon and you can implement any, maybe one. But then I'd have to get some bits out of the snap switch to tell me that I can put into the MIP. There's no such a thing. Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that's missing there. You can't even get like interface counters out of it. It's just a closed.
Yeah, you have to implement interface counters if you want them.
A way to access them. Also, like, I would like a more traditional approach to the control plane process, like the neighbor discovery. What I would like to do is have an efficient packet classifier, which right now I'm doing with libpcap, so it's linked into the system. I just learned that there's a Lua implementation of PPF that people just did, so I can throw out libpcap stuff. But anyway, right when the packet comes in from the interface, I would do this classification with a very efficient packet matching engine. And then if I find a control plane packet, I would like to get it out of the pipeline as fast as possible to some other process, and implement whatever, neighbor discovery, whatever. There, and then I have to get a reply back into the system so it can be transmitted to the interface. So that's also not there yet. It's a matter of figuring out how to do it and figuring out an API or whatever it takes to do that. But the entire system is still very new, and all that. Sooner or later, other people will want to have that as well. And it's just a matter of figuring out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it ends up that you implement like a networking stack in user space on top of the snap switch, which I would also find very interesting. So you can still bypass the kernel entirely with all the benefits you get from running everything in user space, from the performance and also the development. That's a really nice thing. It's so simple. I just edit my code in Emacs and then it's compiled like the entire runtime system is part of the snap switch, and the executable is less than 1 megabyte, and compilation is super fast, and I can do whatever I want, and it's very quick, it's very easy to manage and to troubleshoot and to debug. Really fun to write code like that. That's the way it's supposed to be. So that's a cool thing. If you did that, all of that in a kernel module, it would be terrible. I don't think I would have done that. And it also allows you to bypass everything that you don't want, which is impossible. The Linux kernel has so many things that are, some of them you may be able to turn off, other stuff is just impossible to turn off, but the packets has to go through sections of code that you know you don't need, but it's just there. So I think it would be a cool project to implement an actual IP stack in user space on top of snap switch system. Could be a possibility to write a high-speed IP router with such a thing. I imagine that's basically what the router vendors that run their software on a Linux-based system do. they have their own hardware, and I'm sure they don't write Linux kernel modules to drive them. So it's basically there for management, like my system. The Linux kernel is just there to log into it, to do the management, and the real work is done in interfaces that are detached from the Linux kernel. I just take it away from it. It does no longer see it. And the regular Linux networking is just there to log into the box.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. So, if people want to know more about what you do, where could they find you or your code?
So the code is on my GitHub. If they go look for it, can you find it from the source you bought off?
Or I'll just put that in the show notes. You send me the link and it will be there.
That's where the code is. There is, because I did a presentation on the Terina Networking Conference in May, so that's also online. Mm-hmm. There's a short extended abstract that's published on the Terina website. A little bit of feedback occasionally after the presentation. That market. The fun thing is, so because I also talked about my dislike for MPLS, and then I realized there are basically two classes of people. Ones that completely do not understand what I'm talking about. MPLS is the best thing since sliced bread anyway, so why do you want to get rid of that? And the other ones basically say, yeah, I know what you're saying, and I'm feeling very much the same, but you're forced to use it because that's all we have. So from that I learned that if you can give them a reliable working replacement for it, there would definitely be some interest out there. People actually sympathize with this point of view on reducing your network, just a simple, very robust IP network that does one thing extremely well, which is still the best networking paradigm we have come across. Nobody else could convince me that anything, all the additions that people made, most of them did not make the network better. Many made it worse, actually.
Oh, you wouldn't believe it. Just this morning, I stumbled upon an email where someone refers to something called end-to-end principles.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there was this paper written in 1981 that talks about end-to-end arguments in system design.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we all know that.
I didn't. I just
thought. Oh, really?
I mean, I knew that that was the right way to do things, but I didn't know that the theoretical background is so old and so well documented.
I didn't know that, of course. And it's very clear, very well written, and very understandable. And the core of the argument that most people, I guess, they don't realize that is that it actually says that some features are impossible to implement in the middle of the network. They have to be implemented at the endpoints to make it work. It's actually a very strong argument, and I cannot see how you can disagree with that.
Well, some vendors would forcefully tell you that your view of the world is incorrect.
Yeah, that's the statement. It still doesn't falsify the argument. It just twists it.
Let's wrap it up at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for being with me, Alex. Zibun, thanks for organizing this. This has been wonderful, and I hope that people will, get something out of this conversation and download the SnapSwitch and download your code and start playing with it.
Yeah, I hope so. And also, I'm open to discussion always, so people think that I'm saying it's rubbish or whatever reason. As long as it's a fair argument, they can always try to convince me of something. So I think being open-minded is a very, very important. Because when I sort of accuse the others to be stuck in their mindset, I should be careful that I'm not stuck in mine. So.
Don't worry, there will be anonymous commenters on my blog telling you why you're wrong. And if you stumbled upon this thing by accident, my blog is at blog.itspace.net and my website is at itspace.net, where you'll find all stuff SDN-ish at itspace.net/SDN. If you like the show, don't forget to subscribe at podcast.ibspace.net. Follow me on Twitter, and don't forget, go on iTunes and leave your review, because we still don't have enough reviews. So, do your job. Thank you.